get right back to it. I hope you have the photo page up. We're talking with Harry about a very, very interesting story. This issue of coincidence. At this point in my life, I don't really believe in coincidences anymore. When we're young, we say, wow, that's wild. But when you get a little wiser, I think you begin to see that there is a collective unconscious. I'm not saying everybody's in the collective unconscious, but there is something going on, and things happen. I think people reach out to others and on this strange bandwidth of collective unconscious, and things happen. People are brought together. There are accidents, of course, and there are coincidences, but I think an awful lot of them are not. So that's just my take on it. Things have happened to you, Harry, that just are extraordinary, and I don't know how else to put it. You've been led, you've been directed, you've been encouraged by something, and you have done magnificent things. And everything you've done has been extraordinary. You're more than welcome. So
it's been a great life, and I've got a long time yet to go. I figure I'll live to 110, so I've got a lot of years ahead of me. And thank God I'm coming 82, and I'm in better shape than most 50 or 60 year old guys.
Oh yeah. To stay out of the 120 degree 2 mile hikes in the jungles of South America.
Yeah, that almost got me right after I fell off my roof and broke my back. Was out in La La Land for 3 days, and then 4 days after they
let me. You don't even remember. You don't remember talking to me. I called you in the hospital at least once.
Yeah, I know. My wife told me about it later, but the last thing I remember was that damn ladder shooting out from under my right foot and my left foot getting stuck on the roof, rotating my body, and I thought to myself, this is going to hurt. And I hit my front deck. My head hit the edge of the deck. I should have been dead. But I was out cold for about 10 minutes, and by then the guys in the meat wagon came, and the EMS guy come over and says, how do you feel? I missed my big chance. I should have said, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. But I said, I just fell off my effing roof. How do you think I feel? And he said, well, don't try to get up. I said, no kidding, I can't move. And then 3 days in the hospital that I don't even remember. My wife said I ate 3 meals a day those 3 days.
Yeah.
And then they let me out, and 4 days later I was on a plane down for Buenos Aires. And like you say, damn near died in the jungle down there. But now I can do it because I'm in a lot better shape than I was back then.
Well, Kay was right there, and you're just, she really, she's terrific. And
she's a great lady. She really is.
You got lucky.
Yeah.
I met her
when I was still chasing around with all these girlfriends, and she was going to be just another girlfriend. But 2 weeks after our first date, we were married, and she made me give up all the other girlfriends. And then, you know, hey, it was time for me to settle down. We got Sean Patrick, who's an awesome young man, and Megan, who's 29 and sort of a supervisor at a major corporation. Yeah, God's been good to me.
Well, it works both ways. When I talked to Harry in the hospital, the only thing he kept calling me Lynette, Debbie, or Karen. I don't understand it.
Oh, no, that was long before I fell off my roof.
I know. Yeah. All right. This article says you found 5 crewmates, but only 3 shown there. You weeded 2 more of them out?
No, the other 2 were supposed to come out and meet us in the island, but I was busy enough with Karen, Lynette, and Debbie.
Got it. All right. Very good. Let's go back to our picture tour here. The story is going to have a remarkable ending.
Oh, it is indeed.
We're looking at picture number 6. What gorgeous water. Beautiful.
You're not kidding. And there we're anchored at a place called Darby Island. And this figures in, so put that in the back of your head, Darby Island. It's in the Exuma chain, way, way south. I think there's 300 or so small islands in the Exuma chain, and they're referred to as the Keys in the Bahamas. And Darby Island is way, way, way down toward the southern end. And if you'll click on number 7.
Oh, quick question. How many little islands are there in that portion of the world?
In the Bahamas themselves?
Yeah, the Bahamas. Okay.
I think they said there were 700 islands and about 2,000 or 3,000 keys. Spelled C-A-Y, but it's pronounced key.
What is a key compared to an island?
I guess it has to do with size.
Is a key smaller than an island?
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah.
All right, but
somebody said they think it came from a Spanish word that meant bones or skeletons or something like that for the Florida Keys, which is K-E-Y, but in the Bahamas it's C-A-Y, pronounced key.
Got it. So there are thousands of little islands that things are greenery is on there. There are lots of them.
Just about everything except water. Except there's salt water, but that ain't good for drinking or making tea.
No. All right, excellent. Next picture is number 7.
This is an aerial shot of Darby Island, and that's what that's what got me going. It's for sale right now, you'll notice, for $39 million. They won't take a check from me. Anyhow, here's some things. The smaller island, the long, narrow island up at, above the big island, that's Little Darby, and you can see the ruins of an airstrip. Now, that's not a World War II airstrip. That's one done by the people who bought it right after the war. It's a stall strip, STAL, short takeoff and landing. So you can bring in small aircraft there just for whatever they were doing.
How many linear miles from, let's say, from Florida, the mainland, is this approximately?
Oh, boy. That'd be a guess. Probably 600-700 miles.
All right, it's way
only
down
40 there. Miles right. to the Bahamas, 45 miles to Bimini, but then this is way, you got to go past the Berry Islands, past Nassau and New Providence, and then over to the top of the Exumas, and then down, which is a boomerang-shaped chain with the tail end of the boomerang going further east.
You know, I look at this, I just think of what the Chinese could do with this. They could fill the whole thing in. You know how they do it.
Yeah,
make these damn islands.
Make a big airstrip over there.
Oh, yeah. They could fill the whole thing in and make it a Las Vegas in the Caribbean. Okay. Darby Island.
You've
got things circled, but I'm going to start off with the slightly curved shape on the lower right side below the letter B. What is that curved shape in there? What am I seeing?
Well, before we get on to that, I'll say when we got there, the island is deserted now. During the war years, though, it had 26 freshwater wells, which is incredibly rare for the Bahamas. It was a working plantation, but when we got there in 79, 80, something like that, it was deserted, just an old caretaker. And there was a mansion, which we'll see in a minute.
What are all those things by the letter A along the shoreline? Are those houses?
No. We're not that high up to make the houses look that small. It's just
they look like little houses.
A beach with a bunch of crap on it.
No.
An empty beach.
Got it.
So anyhow, I asked the old caretaker, you know, what's the story with this island? He said, oh, you don't know, man. This was a place we gave food and water to German U-boats, man. And my first thought was those damn Nazis, because that's what we were taught. So I asked him, for a little more proof, and he told me to where to chop on through the underbrush and find the remains of the Radio Shack and the barracks. So, put it in your mind now. A, the circle around A, That's the mansion. Circle around C, that's where my boat was anchored. The circle around B is the Radio Shack. So now let's click on number 8. See what we got on number 8.
Okay, follow the letter A with the arrow.
Yep.
And that the first circle above the top of the arrow is the mansion.
That is correct.
Okay, and now, what is that water? Is that fresh water or salt water in the middle of that Darby Island? That blue water.
Yeah, that was a big saltwater pond.
Saltwater, okay.
Saltwater. They had, like I say, 26 freshwater wells, but they drew the water too fast, and of course it all went to salt, and once they go to salt, they never come back.
They blew it. What were they raising on this island? You mentioned it was
Yeah, they were raising all sorts of vegetables and fruit, and they also had herds of goats. And according to this old black caretaker, because he said pre-German U-boats, I said, there's no way a submarine could get into here. And he said, no, they'd lay offshore. Now, just to the top of that picture, all you got to do is go 100 yards offshore, and you're in Mother Ocean deep. So he said the U-boats would lay offshore, and they'd come out with the two freight boats. They were named Master D and Leander. He said, we'd slaughter goats for a whole week, and then one morning we'd come to work, and the cold house would be empty. They took them out to a U-boat. Now, we never learned if this was true or not. I have never gotten any confirmation.
Did he claim to have seen this?
Say again?
Did he claim to have seen any of these boats?
He never said he saw them. He just said...
That's what it was.
At night, they would send out the freight boats, and they'd come back empty. So we have never confirmed or shot it down, so we don't know. But that's what got me somewhat interested. Because at that time, you know, I researched and stomped around and took pictures and stuff, which was very interesting. But I still had more important things on my mind, like Debbie and Karen. Because Lynette had already gone back home because her boyfriend of many years promised to quit taking her kid sister to bed and behave himself. So she flew home from Nassau.
God.
I can't think of a better reason.
He kept his word.
I never found out.
I have another question.
Yeah.
How can Darby Island have a perfect right angle corner on it like that on the left?
I don't know. Let me go back and look at it here. Oh, yeah, boy, that is a good-looking right. It's natural, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are beaches.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely no man-made work down there at all.
Mm-hmm. Except the airstrip and the mansion.
The airstrip over on Little Darby, that's correct.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Onward.
So if you got a few extra bucks, you can buy it for $39 million. We can go there and renovate.
Buy for 20.
Yeah, I know. Okay, number 8. That's an aerial view of the mansion. And we'll get into the history of that in a little bit. So let's go now to number 9. That's another aerial view of the mansion.
Oh, that's fascinating. And these are trees around that. That's some trees. Yeah.
Yeah, they got lots of scrub trees there. And some of them grow fruits and stuff like that. But lots of scrub.
All right.
And then the next picture,
number
10, that's a photo I took way back. And then, like I say, the old caretaker told me where to stomp through the underbrush, and you look at number 11 and number 12, that's the Radio Shack. It was still there.
That's a black and white picture, number 10. Looks like it.
That's correct. Yeah, 10, 11, and 12, they're all black and white because I was writing magazine articles and they told me they only could use black and white. So I was shooting all black and white.
I see.
So now the story here, like I say, it put the hook in me. So I did some whole bunches of research and there were three really important characters in this story. Sir Harry Oakes, Harold Christie, and oh, hell, what's the third guy's name? The one I don't have a picture of. Guy Baxter. Okay.
Guy Baxter,
all wound up being Sir. Sir this, Sir that, Sir the other thing.
Uh-huh.
We start out with picture number 13, Sir Harry Oakes. I find if you donate enough money to Crown causes, you become a Sir. This was the luckiest guy in the whole British Empire, because he was a dirt poor, dirt grubbing prospector in Canada. And he hopped on a train without bothering to buy a ticket and was heading across the Canadian wherever. And the conductor found out this guy had mooched a ride. So at some stop, he kicked him off right on top of the, I think, the second or the third largest deposit of gold in Canada. So suddenly Sir Harry was a multi-gazillionaire. I think he was the fourth wealthiest man in the British Empire. But they were taxing the hell out of him in Canada. So he moved to the Bahamas, which was a crown colony, where they had no income tax. And they still, to this day, have no income tax. And so he was living there. He was the wealthiest man in the Bahamas. And he was still dressed like an old dirtbag prospector, even though he was worth hundreds of millions, which would be billions in today's money. And he went into the Crown Colony Hotel, which is number 14 there. Now, he looked like hell, and this is a very upscale place. I've stayed there way back many moons ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the maitre d' kicked him out. So the next day he went and bought the hotel and fired the maitre d' that night.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I don't blame him. I'd have done the same thing if I had that kind of money. This place has been in quite a few James Bond movies.
Uh-huh.
If you remember, oh, I forget the name, which movie it was, but it's the one that had Fatima Blush in it. And Thunderball. I think it was Thunderball, yeah. The place I've got circled is the outside bar, and James Bond was out there drinking, and a speedboat came by with Fatima Blush and sprayed him with water, and she turned around and came back and came. She was water skiing, and she went right up and fell right into his arms, and that was right at this very hotel.
You mentioned this is Crown Colony. What is the name of this city?
Nassau.
That is, that's Nassau. Okay.
Right. Nassau is the capital city of the Bahamas. It's on the island of New Providence. So he owned that. He owned all sorts of stuff. And he and Guy Baxter were sort of had a symbiotic relationship. Baxter, I think, owned a whole bunch of islands in the Exumas, and he was selling them to Harry Oakes and a guy named Harold Christie,
mm-hmm.
who's picture number 15, was the broker. He was making money off both guys, buying and selling. And so Guy Baxter owned Darby Island, among others. He also owned a business in downtown Nassau, which Bay Street is the main thoroughfare. And the wealthy white guys there were known as the Bay Street Boys, and they pretty well controlled the Bahamas. As I found out later, the espionage was rampant. The spies were all over Nassau, and Harold Christie, later Sir Harold Christie,
mm-hmm.
and Guy Baxter and Harry Oakes were involved with all these guys. And Sir Harry Oakes turned from being the luckiest guy in the Bahamas to being the unluckiest guy, because and we don't know why, but they think it's because he was opposed to letting the mafia come in with gambling. So one day, Sir Harry Oakes woke up dead. He was in his bed, beaten to death, and then they set the bed on fire. Some of the blisters were wet, which indicated he was still alive part of the time he was being burned.
Mm-hmm.
So then we go to number 14.
What year might that have been, approximately?
Oh, boy.
I'm trying to date this a little bit, if I can.
I think that was either during the war years or just after.
All right.
And the U.S. government offered to let the FBI come in and take over the investigation, but the authorities there said no. They brought over two cops from Miami. And this fellow here on number 16, Count Alfredo Di Marigni, he was a playboy. And the girl there next to him was Sir Harry's daughter. Sir Harry didn't like the guy because he knew the guy was a playboy and just was playing with the girl and maybe trying to get into her dad's wallet. And like I say, one morning, Sir Harry woke up dead, beaten to death. And lo and behold, Count Alfredo Di Marigni's fingerprints wound up on a Chinese screen in Sir Harry's mansion. So they arrested Count Alfredo Di Marigni, otherwise known as...
Where was Sir Harry? All right, we have to pause. Where was Sir Harry's mansion?
That was out of Nassau in the Pine Barrens part of New Providence.
Okay.
It's no longer there. It burned down.
All right. Okay. Hold on right there.
Hold on.
Back in a minute. What a story of intrigue and big money, murder, virgins everywhere. I mean, this cannot be. Well, there are no more virgins. I take that back. This is quite a story. So hold on. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. Talking to Harry Cooper. Great story. All right, Harry, right back into it. Go ahead.
Right back into photo number 16. So anyhow, after Sir Harry was bludgeoned to death, miraculously, some fingerprints of Freddie here, Count Alfredo, wound up on that Chinese screen. And so he was arrested and charged and tried, but was found not guilty. And so he moved to Houston, and he wrote a book called Conspiracy of Crowns, which he autographed and sent to me when he joined Shark Hunters in the early days. So he was a member of Shark Hunters. And did he kill Sir Harry? Nobody knows. But this is more of what got the hook in me for the real history.
Well, when you saw the radio.
Oh yeah.
Building.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And the tower was there. What did you think at the time?
I thought, yeah, these damn Nazis. Damn Nazis were here.
And there's still a piece of radio gear there. It looks like. Something.
Yeah. But this was, you know, not like today's cell phones. I mean, these were big, ugly boxes with
vacuum tubes
in them.
Sure.
Yeah. Most people don't even know what a vacuum tube is. But,
they didn't have solar back then either, so I wonder how they generated electricity.
So they always, any of these occupied islands that
diesel?
Have homes on them, yeah, they have a generator.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So there was no solar. There was one place I went that has nothing to do with this story, but it was further down in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. Some guy owned two islands. They were only about 20 feet apart, and the water was about 8 feet deep between the islands that was 20 feet apart. And he had a water turbine down there, and as the tide would change, you know, you get a 4-knot current, it would turn the props and generate his electricity, and he had batteries to store it.
Nice. Okay, very good.
So,
Next. Julie Adams.
Yeah.
What is Julie Adams doing in this story?
And the Gill Man, can you recognize that guy?
In the green
suit? Yeah, the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
Which was filmed, most of the underwater scenes were filmed at, right 20 miles away from me here, in the Springs. And also there were a couple of James Bond movies filmed there underwater. So this is Rico Browning in that suit.
Okay.
And he, there were two guys that played the Gill Man. He was the one in the water. The other one was the guy out of the water. But Rico Browning lived for undersea adventure, scuba diver. He was the producer of the Flipper series. Remember Flipper?
Yeah.
No. Okay. And also the Mike Nelson Sea Hunt series. That's before
all
your time.
I've seen
too.
Reruns of that one, but that was
right.
Yeah, Mike Nelson played by Lloyd Bridges.
Yep. And this guy here was the producer. He was also a member of Shark Hunters. He's still alive, but he's really, really up there in age. So, but he and another member of Shark Hunters, Big John McLaughlin, they put together a movie called Passion in Paradise, I think was the title, all about the murder of Sir Harry Oakes. So this really even clinched the story more with me. And when I went over there to Nassau, 1982, I think it was, just before I got Shark Hunter started, I wanted to check into the murder of Sir Harry Oakes. And a friend of mine was marketing director for Paradise Island. And he said, don't do it. He says, people that look into Sir Harry Oakes' murder wind up dead. There was one guy wound up at the bottom of a well. Some gal came in. She was a reporter, was asking about it. She wound up dead. So I didn't think anybody was going to kill me. Fortunately, I was right. I went into a real estate office over there, a real estate office that had been formed by Harold Christie. And he's dead now, but his company, H.R. Christie Realty, is pretty big in the Bahamas, I guess. So anyhow, there was a black Bahamian in there running it, and he was very nice, very polite, and I told him I was doing some research, and I was asking him questions. I always like to start with soft questions to put the person at ease, and then I started asking about the murder of Sir Harry Oakes. He physically got furious, jumped out of his chair, grabbed me by the arm, and shoved me out the door. So I was telling my friend who was the sales manager for Paradise Island, he says, you're lucky to be alive. He said, that was Harold Christie's manservant, and he's the guy they think actually beat Harry Oakes to death. So he says, you're lucky. So, okay. So anyhow, that's pretty basically how I got into the got the hook in me, and one day I reached into my wallet. I had $5 left. So I sent my girls home on the airplane. I sailed back from the Exumas through the Bahamas to Key Largo, and put the boat in a marina. And here I am, former vice president of a company, out on Highway 1, thumbing my way back up to Chicago. And I mooched a room for my sister and finally got a job. You can't go knocking on companies and say, hey, are you hiring vice presidents today? And when I got the job, I started to research. And I found out that, I know this is a long way to get to this point, but we're here. I found out that these were not the raving, maniacal Nazis we were told about. These were just young kids who were patriotic Germans, like I was a patriotic young American when I joined the U.S. Air Force, and they were not the vicious murderers, and I felt that any organization that lost that many people, and they were still the most, the only oversubscribed service in the German military, in the Wehrmacht, and they were still waiting to get aboard their boats, even though 9 out of 10 didn't come back from the very first war patrol. And when a submarine goes down, it almost always takes the whole crew with it. So I just thought it was wrong. You've known me for a lot of years, and I cannot stand lies and BS. So I just started Shark Hunters on the 2nd of February, 1983, and we had a whopping 6 members. And by the end of the year, we had 22 members. Mm-hmm. And then we get a couple more. And then in 1987, I put an ad in one of the military magazines. Holy smoke, we're bringing in 60, 70 new members every month. Well, of course, that has dropped off now. We had a total of 8,300 members, but so many of them were up in age when we started Shark Hunters that probably 3,000, 4,000 have passed away. So it's a much smaller organization than I would like, but still we are the only ones that was approved and blessed by the U-boaters, and we have so much information from the U-boat veterans. All our books in the U-boat series are from the veterans' memories. It's not a story that goes through the whole book. Each chapter is a different standalone story by a different veteran, mostly German U-boaters, but other submarine and anti-submarine guys, and we put it together in books. And first-person history, it doesn't get any better than that. This is not stuff that some guy sat in a library and read a book that was written by somebody else, who read a book that was written by somebody else and came to a decision. This was right from the guy who was there. Otto Kretschmer, the top submarine commander of the war, was a good friend. I had a sleeping room in his house. He gave me all sorts of information. Hans-Georg Hess, my best friend in Germany, 21-year-old kid. They gave him command of a combat submarine. And it just goes on and on and on. And then on the American side, Admiral Flucky, the most highly decorated American submariner ever in history. He was a guest in my home. He was on my board. And he gave me stories. So that's, we're the only ones that was approved. And now you got these Johnny-come-lately, internet sites. They've never met a U-boat guy. So they post things. They call them as facts, when really they're just theories, suppositions, fairy tales, etc. So the only factual place you get this information is Shark Hunters, not because I did it, but because the veterans did it.
Remarkable.
It's a lot of fun. And I just had some clown today. He wasn't a member. He just gets our news briefs. And he says, I thought you tried to make money just to support Shark Hunters. Now I see you're just having Shark Hunters to make money.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So I told him what he could do with his suppositions.
Yeah.
I've loaned from my, every time my retirement check comes in at the beginning of the month, I take $2,000 out of it and put it into Shark Hunters. My Rolls Royce that I'm driving is actually, as you know, you've seen pictures of it, the 2001 GMC pickup truck with 263,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not doing this to make money. If I wanted to make money, I'd have stayed in the business world where I was making, 40 years ago when I dropped out to do this full time, I was making between $3,000 and $4,000 a week. A week! You know, I'd sure love to be able to do that again today.
But well, your whole lifetime purpose has never been dedicated to making money.
No.
You do things that are important, that are interesting to you, and serve a greater good. Let's go back to these pictures here and go through this U-boat thing.
Okay. Well, let's look at 18 because our graphics guy, Greg Golinski, designed that, and boy, he hit the nail right on the head. The truth is sacred, and we're not going to be silenced.
No.
Even though the Southern Poverty Law Center tries, and YouTube pulled our entire channel, but we're coming up. We've got another platform, and our guy Ryan Wendland is about to start putting up our short film clips again. And once we get them going, I'll note that to members. Incidentally, your listeners can send me. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No.
Send me an email, sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com, and I'll just send you a copy of the current issue of the magazine electronically. No charge, no obligation, and you see what we're doing.
Yeah, Ryan is a really good guy. He's emails often here and sends material, and really nice that he's working with you. Very nice.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about Shark Hunters. Nobody gets paid. Everybody's a volunteer. Our legal people, our graphic designers like Golinski and Ryan Wendland, like me, like Kate, like my daughter who does our secretary stuff. She's making $57,000 bucks a year working for her regular company, so she doesn't need anything from us. But nobody gets a salary. Nobody, zero. We used to. Back in the old days, I paid myself $250 a week, and my wife got $200 a week. But then along came Barack Obama, and the economy changed.
Well, Barack is back. He's running the show
now. I know it. Him
and Rice.
Yeah. What's her name? What's her first name?
Susan Rice. Isn't
Susan Rice, yeah.
The one who
stopped at the airfield to talk to Bill Clinton about their grandchildren.
I don't know if that was Susan Rice or not. But
well, maybe I got my current events screwed up.
No, I don't think it was Susan Rice. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, let's get back to these pictures. Yeah.
Back to these pictures. Okay, you look through. Now, the skipper, that's number 20. That's Werner Lott, was the commander of this boat. And photo number 19 shows the boat before it got modified, shall we say. Yeah. And 21, look at 21. Talk about looking like you ran into a gigantic can opener, and then you got 22, 23. That's the now the metal there is very thin. It's only like eighth of an inch thick. This is the outer hull. The pressure hull now is a little over an inch thick, and there was no damage to that. Then you look at 24. It looks like some gigantic metal munching monster got it. And 25.
Again, that's all the exterior, very thin metal. It just makes it aerodynamically,
correct.
Or I guess hydrodynamically.
And in 25, you also see the damage to the conning tower. But this is the fairing to the conning tower. The conning tower itself is a vertical tube. That's about an inch thick, too. So none of the structural part got hurt. Now, if you ever saw the movie Down Periscope starring Kelsey Grammer, they were trying to sneak into a harbor and defeat the opposing sonar. So what they did, they found a big tanker going in, and they said they were going to wear it like a hat. In other words, they were going to get right underneath the tanker to where the tanker's signature was the only thing that showed up on the sonar.
This is Kelsey Grammer in a World War II film?
No, it wasn't World War II. He was allegedly a screw-up in today's modern nuclear navy, and they gave him command of an old diesel boat for some kind of exercise they were doing. And who the hell else was in it? not too many famous people in it other than Kelsey Grammer. But anyhow, they ran the boat, the submarine. They used the, what the hell boat is it? The one they got out at San Francisco. They used that one in the movie. And they were going to wear this tanker like a hat. That's what they said. Now, whether this was the same effort, this was pre-war, 1938. This boat, U-35, which was a Type 7A, was going after the Graff's Bay as a practice target, and somehow they got into the same space, and this is what happens when you run under the propellers of a battleship.
The Graff's Bay chewed up that U-boat front like that?
Yep.
Oh, that's amazing.
It made a hell of a mess.
I made a hell of a noise, too, I'll bet.
Like I said in my teasers on the Hotmails, what happened to the crew? Well, there was no injuries, but I'll bet there were plenty of soiled underwear.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Because this
thing, just amazing.
It didn't happen all at once. You hear ka-tong, 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 ka-tong for probably 10 seconds. And they're thinking, what the hell's going on
and
here?
And it got all the way back to the shroud
to the
around
tower.
The conning tower. Yeah.
Yep.
Look at
and,
that.
Like I said, if the prop had busted into the pressure hull, it would have been all over. They would have died. And this was in the Baltic.
They were just practicing, sneaking up on big boats. I got it.
Right. Didn't work. They lost quite a few submarines out there in the Baltic because they'd be practicing, and they only had a small little area.
Mm-hmm.
And when the submarine's running submerged, and if another sub is running submerged in the same area, they'd crash. And this happened, yeah. I'll bet you, half a dozen times. They lost about half a dozen boats over there.
You know, I sent you a video, which you'd probably already seen, of them pulling up a U-boat and actually refurbishing it. It's in Germany now on display.
It's in England.
It's in England?
That was U-534.
It was a German guy who took the tour then. What I saw was next to the monument for all the U-boat people who died.
Then they didn't pull that one up. That was the boat of my best friend in Germany, Hans-Georg Hess, who used 995.
It survived. Yeah.
Four of them were given to Norway as reparations or whatever, and they were the K boats. Each boat was given a name in Norway that began with a K, and this one was Kaura. Now, U-570 had been interned by the Spaniards during the war and then used later, and when they didn't need it anymore, they offered it to the German government for a token payment of one peso or whatever, and the German government says, hell no, World War what? Adolf who? Get that thing out of here. So it got broken up for scrap. But then when the Norwegian government was decommissioning these four boats, they offered one of them, Kaura, to the German government, and the German government again said, no way. And then they offered it to the German submariners, the VDU, Verband Deutscher U-Bootfahrer, for one kroner or whatever, and they said, yeah, hell yes. So it was never sunk. It was always in commission.
I see.
But we were over there, and I was on that boat I don't know how many times with Hess, and one time we were doing a documentary, and they got permission. Hess got permission. We could be up on the conning tower. So we went up through the hatch and out onto the conning tower, and I dropped down onto the foredeck, and my friend Hess says, you know, in typical German way, Harry, we have permission for the conning tower. We do not have permission for the deck. Okay. I got back up in the tower. Yeah, that's U-995, a Type 7C. It's similar to this one that got chopped up, only this was a Type 7A. The C variant was a little bit longer, had much bigger fuel tanks, and the A was the only submarine I've ever heard of that had the stern tube above the waterline. Everybody else had all their tubes were below the waterline. And they only made a handful of the seven A's. But the seven C's, they made hundreds of them. And they're all dead.
Altogether, how many U-boats were produced approximately? Service boats.
Well over 1,000, maybe 1,200. I'd have to, we've got all the documents here, but I'd have to check on it. But they, 1,200. They didn't, naturally, they didn't all get into operation at once. That would have been a hell of a fleet. But at the beginning of the war, they only had 57 submarines, and only about a third of them were Type 7s that could go out into the open ocean. The others were Type 2s, which the Germans referred to as the dugout canoes, or Eisenbaum. Crew of 25 people, two or three officers, the rest enlisted men. They had three tubes forward, so they'd go out with all three tubes loaded and two spare torpedoes, and when you got all five shot, you go home. Whereas later, like the nine, the ocean-going boat, the nine seas, they had like 22 torpedoes on board, which was a good idea, except they couldn't use them long enough because they'd either get sunk or chased away.
Any thought of a lot of these boats are on the bottom. We got to run here, but they're relatively, many of them, were not disintegrated and destroyed. They're in good shape. They had a massive crack.
Great minds think alike. One of our members, who's a good friend of mine, Uli, from over on the east coast of Florida, he's German, he had the same idea. We're supposed to go find a U-boat, either Type 2 or Type 7, that is in water that's not destroying them, raise it and bring it over to probably Port Canaveral and open a museum to the Battle of the Atlantic.
You got it. Yep, I think it'd be an appropriate thing, and if they're the remains of any of the crew, they would get proper burial, that kind of thing.
No, we would not go after any of those because those are war graves. But the Type 2s, the whole 30th U-boat flotilla in the Black Sea, they scuttled all five out of
did.
The
that's
six.
That's right. All right. That's the kind of thing I was looking at. Yeah. Good.
Or Operation Deadlight, where they had 300 of them. They were towing them out to super deep water off of Ireland, but some of them foundered and sank in 100 feet of water. So, no, we would never touch a war grave, but these lots of boats were sunk with nobody aboard.
There are boats worth bringing up like that.
That's what we're looking into.
We like that. All right, Harry, thank you. Wonderful program. A lot of answered questions tonight. Interesting look back at just a bit of your remarkable life. So this is fun. Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun, and it's just getting started.
Yeah. Okay, my friend. Talk soon.
All right. Good deal. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. You betcha. Good night. Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. And if you want to join something that will never cease to fascinate you, this is the thing you want to get into. Okay. We'll be right back.